Sally Warhaft
on radio, online and on digital. The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and on ABC Victoria.
It is the last Conversation Hour for the year, but we've saved the best for last. We've got a couple of really interesting and quite different filmmakers joining us a little later in the program, Jonathan Teplitsky and Ruben Alvers. And Jonathan's just finished making a film based on Eric Lomax's very beautiful and distinguished memoir, The Railway Man. And Ruben Alvers is a filmmaker who's just cleaned up the 2013 European Film Awards People's Choice Prize for his film, The Gilded Cage. And joining me to, well, take us through this lovely last Conversation Hour of the year is David Astle. And
distinguished filmmaker.
Distinguished, distinguished. What do you call yourself if you're a crossword?
What I love to say to the Australian tax office is, I'm a crypto cruciverbalist, because then they never know what I can claim for.
Yeah, David Astle will be known to so many of you as, the guy who writes the crosswords for The Age under what? DA.
Yeah, DA.
Yeah.
Has many interpretations as well, Sally.
Of course, though, also the author of a couple of best-selling books, his latest being Clutopia, the story of 100 years of the crossword. Congratulations, David.
Thanks a lot, Sally.
The first thing that struck me was that the crossword is only 100 years old.
It is a little staggering. Even I was gobsmacked when I learnt that a few years ago.
I would have thought that it would be something that accidentally came about centuries and centuries ago.
Maybe humankind was a bit slow in this regard. You know, we got ahead of, we came up with horse and carriage pretty quickly. We certainly worked out how to bend and flex metal. But when it came to word squares, we were very happy with squares alone. In other words, just a magic square without any black squares in the midst. And that was the breakthrough in 1913. I mean, you can talk about cold fusion or it may be the assembly line or stainless steel, but for me, it's when Arthur Wynn put black squares inside a white box that breakthrough moment.
I mean, human beings like puzzles, don't they? And it's hard to believe that they didn't like puzzles, 400 years ago. But perhaps there was a lot going on with the development of language, wasn't there? That at what point do human beings stop and say, we're so on top of this, we can make a puzzle out of it?
You're right about the antiquity of puzzle play and word play. And even when they scratched around in Pompeii, they discovered word squares along with some fantastic graffiti. Greeks have been mucking around with palindromes. They have this thing called booster feed on, which is this amazing form of writing that goes from left to right and then right to left, which mimics the idea of an ox pulling a plow. That's what the literal meaning of the word. And then you've got the Kabbalists, who converted the sacred texts into codes. Queen Victoria loved the acrostic, which are those series of puzzles where there's a secret message that reads down a certain column of letters.
Oh, the greatest crosswords ever done have to do more than be just one thing, don't they?
They do. And in fact, that's putting together Clutopia. That was my quest, to find crosswords that were remarkable.
What's your favourite? You got a very, where you think, oh, if I could have done that.
I think my favourite actually was Vladimir Nabokov, author of Lolita, fantastic surrealist, a great creator of novels, narratives, a word master. He lost his father when he was only in his early 20s. This is when he was living in exile in Berlin with his family, his four other siblings and his parents. And his father was assassinated, essentially, in the early 1920s when he leapt in front of a Bolshevik bullet to block the Tsarist speaker from being killed. And so Vladimir Sr. was killed, and what Vladimir Jr. turned his hand to was tennis coaching, also a very handy tennis player, language tutoring, and crossword making.
Really?
Yeah, and so I found Vladimir's very first crossword.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, it was, and even more amazing, the word that I chose right in the heart of this Krestelovitsu, which Vladimir called the crossword, he coined that word, was Ada, A-D-A. And that was his favourite word and favourite name because it represents a butterfly, which was his other great love.
Of course it was. It's comforting to know somebody like him was interested in crosswords because I know that, I love reading probably, you know, more than any other mm-hmm. activity, but I feel guilty, sometimes doing a crossword because I quite like puzzles, you know, to do a crossword every now and again. I'm not an everyday crossworder, but I probably would be if I didn't feel guilty about it and think, you know, I should be reading. Tell us what you know about what's going on in the brain when somebody's doing a crossword, because we know they say for elderly people who do crosswords tend to have a later onset or less onset of dementia and things like that.
That's true.
What is the crossword? Do you know what it does?
Yeah, I do know what it does. There's a little thing that's in the temporal gyrus, it's called, and it's the thing that's tadpole-shaped, and it's the part of the brain that actually is activated by crossword solving, which sounds so bizarre, but what it does, it forces this part of the brain to make fresh connections. Usually, this is the same part of the brain that is very useful in things like interpreting metaphors, double meanings, innuendos, and also map reading, this same part of the brain. And when we become more fog-bound with that terrible plight that is dementia, it's that part of the brain, those associations and that creative kind of free thinking that often is the thing to be lost first. So crosswords have been proven through all sorts of MRI tubes and longitudinal studies to be of maximum benefit in that regard. It's not just about vocab retention. It's also about nuance. It's about second and third meanings of words and how you can avoid pitfalls when it comes to cryptic clues.
Crosswords must have been used I suppose this is obvious, but in espionage as a way to get codes across borders and so on?
Yeah, infamously. In fact, in 1944, there was a series of crosswords in the Telegraph that actually sort of betrayed sensitive covert operational names to a point that MI5 had to go and visit the compiler, you know, with a waterboard in the boot. And he was completely flabbergasted when he was accused of betraying this state secrets. And it came to light that, in fact, all these sensitive words, unlikely as they were, Juno, Overlord, Mulberry, Neptune, these were just words that he had gleaned from his schoolboys. He was actually a teacher. And these same boys had spent a lot of time in the adjoining military encampment. So it would seem as though these boys, just by osmosis, had collected all these sensitive terms, most likely not knowing their meaning, and carrying them back to the classroom like vectors.
Isn't that... Because, we know they use really complex codes in the Second World War particularly, but I guess in others as well, that it's the same part of the brain. It's just not as fun.
Yes, that's right. And look, that was the other thing too. With Glutopia, I was just delighted to find that there have been wedding proposals in crosswords. There have been propaganda... Russian propaganda in Czechoslovakia. There's been even a crossword strike on the Glasgow docks because a couple of welders were caught doing the crossword when they should have been, you know, fixing up the hull.
And people get terribly upset when their crossword person, was it the Guardian crossword, the equivalent to you, the Guardian's crossword, whatever it is you
compiler,
call it, compiler,
setter, yep.
Did he retire this year after 30 years or something? And there was an outpouring of upsetting.
He did something
this.
Even more emphatic than that. He died and he declared his terminal illness inside a crossword.
That's right.
Which
that's
is
right.
staggering. And in fact...
He did. It was cancer, wasn't it, in the crossword?
Yeah, he had esophageal cancer. His name was John Graham, better known, infamously known as Araucaria. And with Glutopia, I thought I had to find a crossword for every year in the century, and his crossword for 2013 had to be the crossword that was anointed because, unlike any other crossword in the past, he was a setter of great calibre and repute. I mean, he was a he was a Goliath. I'm nothing like him.
I read his obituary. It just was a, it just was one of those things I chanced across and a few weeks ago. Yeah,
haunting. And yet, very importantly, one of the key words that he had in this, what really was a deathbed crossword, was merriment. Because that's what the crossword also does. It brings great joy, and he certainly brought endless joy to three generations of solvers in the UK and here in Australia.
Should you worry, David, if, like me, you just can't do the cryptic crosswords?
Don't worry.
I do worry. I've never successfully finished a cryptic crossword in my life.
You haven't.
I've got a PhD.
The right sensei grasshopper.
And I think it's all over for me.
No, don't be like that. In fact, you are. I can see in this interview just how nimble-minded and you've got real verbal dexterity. You have got a mercurial mind. All you need is just to be led to the chessboard and understand what the horsey does. It's called a knight, and that's how the knight moves. It's the same in crossword, cryptic crosswords. Each piece, each clue has its own set of rules. There are anagrams, there are homophones, there are reversals.
So is this about you've got to know both those general, there's sort of one column of rules, and then there's another column of knowns that are clues that you see over and over and over again. Is that right?
Yeah, there are no known knowns, but there are some unknown unknowns. That's right. No, it is about learning to detect what clue you're looking at. And in fact, I heard a beautiful analogy the other day that what each cryptic clue is, because each clue is made up of two parts, wordplay and the sort of the definitions, and to find out where the line of division falls is pretty much like trying to get the end of a sticky tape roll. So when you're fiddling around with a sticky tape roll, it's a lot like trying to juggle a cryptic clue. You try and interpret where to make that line of division, where that seam falls, and then you will be able to isolate what is just a straight definition and what is the piece of mischief that is the wordplay.
You see how intently I'm listening
you
to
are,
you.
You are. Look.
And you know what? I'm getting on a plane tomorrow. I'll take a cryptic cross and I can guarantee when I get to the other end, there'll be nothing there.
That's what I want to hear. See?
David, you are very, very clever. The author of Cluetopia. It's out now. It's the story of 100 years of the crossword, 1913 till 2013. And it really does look like a must read. I'll take that on the plane so that I don't, go mad when I can't work
keep
out
the conversation
the,
alive.
Yeah.
Right here on 774 ABC Melbourne.
David Astle, my co-host, and I are joined by Jonathan Teplitsky, filmmaker. And good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
It's lovely to have you here. You're here because you have a new film about to come out, The Railway Man, and a film based on the memoir, the best-selling and very, very beautiful memoir by Eric Lomax.
Mm.
Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And, now I should say I haven't had a chance to see this. The previews were not, the timings didn't work at all. There were only a couple. But I did read the book. And as I read it, I thought, gee, it's film material.
Mm.
Tell us how you came to make this film.
Well, the actual project has been in development for 15 years and I've only been on it for four. So a lot of the heavy lifting was done before I came along. But it started off as very much an adaptation of the book, and it's very true to the book in many ways. But in fact, Eric sat down quite soon after the war and wrote everything he could remember of his treatment by the Japanese, his internment by the Japanese, and about the individual Japanese that he dealt with. You know, it was very important to him to remember some of these and to pass on to the authorities what he'd remembered. And then he put it in a drawer for 25 years. And it wasn't until he started going through some of the rehabilitation of the sort of emotional, psychological stress and trauma that he'd suffered, that he was encouraged to go back and finish the book, and that's really where that came from. But
so he Eric Lomax, a prisoner of war on the Burma Siam, the Railway of Death, as it was known. I mean, perhaps the most timely and interesting and, of course, unforeseeable for you thing about this is that he was a man of remarkable forgiveness. In the week where South Africa is burying Nelson Mandela, when you talk about facing up to your oppressor of not punishing the oppressor, he really... this happened before Nelson Mandela gave this message. Tell us a bit more about Eric, because you met him.
I met him many times and actually, became very close to both him and his wife, Patty. I mean, the thing that struck me so profoundly about this story was that it was just this very succinct story about the very worst and the very best of human nature. And in many ways, it sort of defines what it is to be human, you know, what we're capable of, you know, doing to each other on, you know, a good and a bad way. And the thing about Eric when I first met him was that it struck me so strongly that he was a 89-year-old, 90-year-old man at peace with the world. And I knew what he'd been through. And to get that feeling of incredible peace around him was sort of amazing and remarkable.
But his first reflex, you know, to tell the full story was not of forgiveness.
In fact, he had
a murderous heart. He had so much rage and bitterness in his soul Paddy actually helped slowly to elicit.
Yeah. I mean, he, you know, his full intention was to, when he discovered that Nagase, this Japanese interpreter who was part of what had happened to him, was still alive, was to go out to Thailand, confront him and to kill him. And one very chilling moment when Colin Firth and I were visiting him in Berwick-upon-Tweed was we asked him very directly, you know, what was your intention? What would you have done? And he said, my intention was to go and kill the man. So vengeance and revenge were very much a result of the hatred and the, you know, what he was feeling for so many years, built up over so many years. You know, he had nightmares every single night of his life. And it wasn't really until he decided, you know, once he'd gone to confront Nagase, it set in motion a very, very kind of complex process. Because I think forgiveness, reconciliation, they're not things that just happen overnight. You know, they're things that is very much a process that you, in a way, rediscover your own humanity. And I think forgiveness is as much about the forgiver as it is about what the forgivee is entitled to,
Like oppression.
Exactly.
The flip side of oppression.
Exactly. You know, and you know, in Nagase, Eric discovered a man who had really tried to make amends, had recognised what he had been involved with. But, you know, I think also, and I'm sure Eric, you know, recognised this, but we forget very quickly just how young these guys were. I mean, they were kids sent into incredibly dangerous, brutal, morally ambiguous situations. And out of that, you know, despite how badly he was treated, somehow he managed to, you know, in a sense, take that path of humanity rather than, you know.
It's also, too, it was not just Paddy who he met on a train. Of course, Eric's life seemed to revolve around trains. He loved trains as a young boy growing up in Edinburgh. The crucial, you know, the kind of savage irony of working on the death railway. And even on set, I believe he was fascinated by the dolly tracks.
That's right, yeah.
Just wanted to know their gauge.
One day he came on set, he was lifted onto the set by all the grips in his wheelchair, and his main focus was on on the gauge of the dolly track. So, yeah, and he had that sort of sense of humour all the way to the end. And that, you know, that I think is as much a telling factor in someone who has moved on and let go of the terrible things that had happened to him.
Colin Firth plays him, as you've mentioned, Colin Firth, and Nicole Kidman plays Patty, his second wife. What was it like to be with Colin and Eric when they met? As a film director, you've cast Colin Firth, who's an intelligent, sensitive human being.
Very much so, yeah.
Into this role of a living person. Tell us what that was like.
I mean, it was an amazing first meeting because, you know, you go knowing so much about a person and they know nothing about you. Mm. And in many ways...
And Eric Lomax didn't know who Colin Firth was.
No. He actually... Yeah. There was a when we cast Colin, and completely unrelated story, on the front of Eric's newspaper, there was a photograph of Colin to do with something else. And Paddy said to him, "This is the man that they've cast in the movie to play you." And he said, "Oh, God, he's on the front of the newspaper. He must be someone famous." And so he had no idea who he was. And so it was a great way to start that relationship in many ways. It wasn't like a great Hollywood actor was coming to visit my home sort of thing. It was, you know, he had a great dignity and a great sense of self. And I think Colin really respected that in Eric. And, you know, for me as a director to see, you know, the actor and the subject come together like that, you know, with such an energy and such a chemistry in many ways, you know, is a fascinating thing. And, you know, you start to get excited that the film that you are about to embark on, which is always a daunting prospect, you know, has great substance and great foundation to it.
He didn't get to see the film.
No.
Really sadly, he was 93, I think.
92, I think.
92 when he died, Eric Lomax, just before the film was made. But what's your sense of how he would have responded to it? Because his memoir, he's a beautiful writer.
Mm.
Really, quite a way he's got with words. Do you feel that the film reflects that beauty?
I hope so. I mean, I hope it is an emotional and poetic interpretation of his life and his experiences. Certainly, both Paddy and Eric were very involved in, you know, as we wrote the script, as we developed the script. You know, they read every draft of it. We talked a lot about, you know, how a film in a sense takes a life and then interprets it in 2 hours. Which they, you know, understood and accepted and what have you. Just going back to what you're saying before, I actually don't think Eric would have ever sat down and watched the film.
Right.
I think it's about stuff that he didn't need to go back to, but he was incredibly thrilled about that it was being made. And, you know, and I think they were very involved and very chuffed with being part of that process.
In fact, the conversation we had just before we went on air, you mentioned that some of those soldiers who were recruited to build that railway have actually seen the film in the UK, I understand.
Both here and in the UK. We've done screenings for the RSL here as well. And
that must have been quite exacting as a director, essentially parading this for the test of authenticity.
Well, you know, there's nothing more potent than showing it to the people who, you know, whose experience is replicated in the film. And what was so wonderful is that both here and in the UK, just how strongly they've responded. And not just veterans of World War II, you know, veterans of Afghanistan, Iraq and Vietnam as well, and all other conflicts, you know, that it is a universal experience, what it is to be sent as a young person to war.
So you're the younger actors who play the soldiers on the railway are terrific. Jeremy Irvine as a younger Colin Firth, Eric Lomax, is superb. How did you get him to make? How did you make him so skinny? How did you actually get that kind of POW look?
There's only one way to do it, isn't there?
Yeah, there is only one way.
There's only one way.
If there was any other way, David, everyone would be doing it.
This is the POW diet. Are you listening, people? Get your paper and pen.
Yeah, I mean that's basically it. And there was a time in Thailand where it was incredibly hot, where we actually had to tell Jeremy to eat more because he was losing so much weight that he was feeling faint at times. And you need some sort of energy to do the acting. You know, it's fine to get into character, and it's fine to, you know, replicate the experience as much as possible. But, you know, you've got to have the energy as well to do the performance.
Just one other thing I read in the press, so Sally, that I loved was that for all the indignities and torments that the actor, Jeremy, had to suffer, it was important for Colin, who plays the future, the sort of future self, those two actors having to work in close cahoots to sort of almost ensure that the pain that Eric felt was the pain that Eric nursed as an older man. Tell us a bit how that that kind of transaction happened.
Well, you know, we work very hard on the idea that whenever you're watching the film, whether it's Colin or whether it's Jeremy, that you're always following Eric. And the two of them work together a lot, and Jeremy, replicated a lot of Colin's speech patterns. Colin's an incredibly generous actor, particularly when you know, in this instance, when he's sharing the role with him. And in many ways, Colin's performance is all the greater for the fact that he actually had to. He doesn't, as an actor, doesn't even have to, or doesn't even get to play out the things that happened to him. So he had to create that darkness and that sort of terrible treatment in his own preparation. Because all he does in the film really is I say all he does, it's a huge thing, you know, is respond emotionally and psychologically to what had happened to him.
He bears the weight.
He bears very much so. Mm. And in a way that's the energy of the film.
You're listening to Jonathan Teplitsky, filmmaker. You might know him from his previous acclaimed film, Burning Man, but his new film, The Railway Man, is out, and The Railway Man looks sure to become another Jonathan Teplitsky classic. So congratulations.
Pleasure being here.
Jonathan and David Astell and I will be joined very soon by another filmmaker, but a very different kind of film, Ruben Alves.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Welcome, Ruben.
Hey.
Ruben is here because he has made a really beautiful film and a film that has taken off in Europe called The Gilded Cage. And welcome to the Conversation Hour, last Conversation Hour for the year, and a sort of filmmaker's special, really, isn't it, David?
A cinematic
paradise.
Feast.
That's right. Yeah. Now, tell us first a little bit about this film, which it's a charming, beautiful film about a family, a couple, particularly the Portuguese couple in Paris, who, you tell us, you take it from there.
Yeah, it's my first movie. So I apologize about my English. It's very basic.
I think I was so, told you
just
could
say
do,
basic again. That's
I was
so
told
sexy.
You could do the Conversation Hour in three languages, and we
maybe.
Your English is just fine, Ruben. You go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay, so go ahead. It's my first movie. I dedicated this movie to my parents because. Yeah, it's about the Portuguese immigrants in France, and I think we needed to have a representation of this community because it's a so discreet community. They are making no noise and are always working, and when I saw a documentary about a concierge, a Portuguese concierge in Paris, the last question the journalist says is, "You're thinking to going back to your country?" And she said, "Yes, of course. I wanted to go back to Portugal, but at the same time, I feel so good, so nice here in my gilded cage, and I have an epiphany. And I say, okay, that's the condition of this person I want to talk about.
This film takes some themes that Australians would be really familiar with, about family, about belonging, about immigrants, about the longing for homeland, but they're in a setting in this film that I think we don't hear a lot about in Australia, and that is Portuguese immigrants in Paris, in France, that like every immigrant community, you realise watching this film that it's about stereotypes and clichés, and some of them are true, but some of them aren't true as well. Tell us about how you've used stereotypes in this film.
I think it's important, to use the stereotype, but using well, I'm using it, but to make love about it, because I think stereotype, not most of the time, but often it's reality, actually. So in the movie, I think there is a lot of stereotypes, but they are real. It's reality, and it's very good to assume it. And I made it because I think it's important, like maybe Portuguese, the Portuguese assume they're immigrants also. But it's not also about Portuguese immigrants. I think all the immigrants can be touched by
yeah, the, be related
the movie.
To it.
Yeah, be related to.
Because, in fact, looking at your own background, Ruben, you are of Portuguese ancestry. Your mother is a concierge and your father works on construction sites, exactly. just like Maria and Jose. Yeah. There is an adolescent boy who is part of this family living on the ground floor. This is, in a way, it is a biopic that is also disguised beautifully and so elegantly as a charming comedy. I mean, is this the one film in you? Is this the film that you had to make and have no other films to make? Tell us about your own life in this situation.
Yeah, actually, it's my parents' life. It's not autobiographic, but it's much inspired, yes, for sure. I think I am all the characters a little bit, but it's, for example, my uncles, my aunties, my cousins, they are all in movies.
Are they really?
Yeah, and neighbors and all immigrants, and it's my observation also. And I think I had the feedback to do that because I start to write. I was 30. And I think, like, okay, I'm mature enough to have the feedback to talk about this community, but it's not my life. Mm-hmm. It's a fiction.
I was just going to ask you because you're making this film about your parents, and in The Railway Man, I was dealing with real people. I'm just interested, as a fellow filmmaker, what it was like to, in a sense, show, make it about real people who you're very close to and then have to show them the film and what their reaction was.
The reaction was strange because my father, they didn't know that they know that I was writing about Portuguese, but they didn't know that it will be their life. They're gonna see. And my father, the first time he see like a small trailer, it looks like the movie, and a friend of mine goes and, "So, Francisco, what do you think?" And he says, "I've seen my cup in the movie," because I use a lot of stuffs of my parents through, because my accessories chief and so on.
Props and
he says to me, "I'm thinking about this look at the stuffs I want," and I say, "But why, you're gonna rent it?" And he said, "Yes." And I say, "Stop, Papa, Daddy. Yeah, you are in the country house. Okay, so my team's gonna come and gonna take all
just
the
loot your house
to make like true." And my father looks and he says, "It's my cup of tea in the one of my cups."
It's also really interesting when you write something so close to your experience. I mean, I did this with Burning Man, and in the end, we ended up filming part of it in my own house, which I would never do. I put my family through hell to do it. But, because you see it in one, it's like with that cup, it's got to be that one cup because it represents something really important to you.
Yeah, but I had this attention, to have the feedback of that. Yeah. And that's why I take a co-writer, French, and he doesn't know nothing about Portuguese culture. But I say, "What do you know about Portuguese?" And say, "Football." And I said, "Okay, it's good for me."
One of the real themes in the film is the idea, Maria does this so beautifully, the character, it portrays this sense of being just completely taken for granted, and her husband as well. Is that a sort of metaphor for how Portuguese people in France are seen? Are they taken for granted, or do they feel that they're taken for granted as an entire community?
Yeah, I feel like it's probably historic from history of Portugal, because they live a poor country in dictature, Salazar dictature in 60s, 70s, and he finds in France a better life, like an economic independence and intellectual independence too. So. They don't have to make noise, so they not swim, but they work so and they don't know to say no. Actually, they don't know say no, and it's like always work, not making noise. And the new generation, the daughter in the mm-hmm. movie says like they are, she's like a little bit upset about that. Like wake up now,
speak up,
stop. Mm. And because they are close in this world and take for granted. And for example. It's about devotion also because I thought like this immigration is completely devoted to the boss.
I'm going to have to ask you though, Ruben, and I know this is not a biopic, but that's a very important scene when the daughter says that you are like comfortable slaves, but you are slaves. You know, you have to stop living like this. Mm-hmm. Did you, as a young man, have that kind of realization, that speech with your parents? Have you deliberately tried to live differently from your parents?
Maybe, mm-hmm. maybe. I've never thought about that, actually. But maybe. The thing is, I often thought about that, like, okay, stop being like slaves. Mm. And maybe I take my life different.
Mm. And the other thing I must add is I think an ordinary filmmaker would treat this story very seriously, when in fact you... being an extraordinary filmmaker, have given it so much grace and humour and still dealt with serious issues. Was that always the decision when you approached this film?
Yeah, because I think you can talk about profound and deep things, but the way I like the way, like light way, like comedy, because it's important to people like to make love of to make love of ourselves. And I like humor and comedy. For me, the life is like that. In the same minute, you can like laugh and receive a phone call and mm-hmm. tragedy, and you start crying. And so I tried in my first movie to make all these emotions, and Portuguese has this because they are Latin. So it's a scream, a tragedy. 1 second after that, everyone laughing, and it's like wow.
So often that contrast is really good between comedy and pathos, or comedy and irony, and something serious and something funny, and it actually makes the comedy more potent, I think.
Exactly.
You know, it comes from the characters, and as opposed to it being a set-up joke or something, you know, and I think that's it's a really powerful way of telling those sort of stories.
It's easy to give some deep...
And also, no matter how hard or terrible situations are, there's always a sense of humour that comes through. You know, no matter what situations people are in, they always try to lighten the load, or they always try and deal with things by using comedy, by using their sense of humour.
It's that different, the way you take your life.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a light touch, though, that you give it. It's not heavy-handed.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that in getting back to the Railway Man, your film, Jonathan, I know the relationship between Patty and Eric was really well captured in humour. There's a wonderful remark that Patty says about, I've never kissed a man with a moustache and I never will again, which is her way of saying lose the moustache.
She never kissed a Portuguese. Yeah. All a moustache.
But there was very little humour. And having just read the Richard Flanagan book, sometimes it's humour that gets you through tough situations. I noticed there was not so much humour, though, in the Thai-Burma scenes. Was that, again, a deliberate decision? If so, why?
Look, I think you're right. And I have absolutely no doubt that a lot of those men survived with the camaraderie and the humour that got them through.
There's not a lot of it in the book, is there?
No. Mm-hmm. You spend so much trying to balance the sort of, the weight of the story and the weight of the drama and making that work. You know, that we tell the story in two very distinct time frames. And just to get that to work, sometimes it's quite hard to find those moments. I mean, wherever possible, we tried to bring in a warmth, a sort of a quiet humour to those scenes between them, between Patty and Eric. But, I think it's not a laugh fest, no.
No, not at all. But there's plenty of humanity. But it was the comedy quotient that was there in a kind of romance and not there in war.
Yeah. Well, I think also that, I was conscious of not being flippant as well. Mm. And it's, the responsibility of doing justice to someone's real story, particularly when they've endured so much, is so important, I think, that without becoming too earnest, you know, I was happy to, in a sense, rely on the drama and rely on the power of that to, in a sense, engage the audience.
Ruben, yours is a French film, but it stars two very well-known Portuguese actors as the central couple, of which you can pronounce their names much better than me.
Joaquim de Almeida, Rita Blanco.
See how much better. what was it like, even though it is a French film, in the sense that you were working with these actors, it was a co-production, I suppose, in your head, given your experience. what was that like?
Yeah, in my head, for sure. Because, it's a French movie, but it's so much Portuguese soul and my main characters. Because I thought that it was important for the authenticity of the movie to take Portuguese actors. And the fact is, when I tell this, I say this to the producers, French producers, they look at me like, what? Portuguese actors?
They wanted big French stars, didn't they?
Yes, for sure. Nowadays, it's complicated to, you know, to create, to make a movie, and we need like some...
It must be great, though, that your instincts...
Yeah.
With the success of the film, your instincts are right. And, you know, so often, you know, it's so important that the person who has the vision for the film and the person who, in a sense, takes the greatest responsibility for it, whose name is on the film, you know, is listened to in terms of, because your instinct is all you have to go on.
And, I mean, like The Railway Man, you've got Colin Firth and Nicole Kidman. These actors are really well known.
Yeah, in Portugal.
And well, in the world too. I mean, the guy who plays Jose has lived in the United States, I think, for 3 decades. And he'll be familiar to anyone who sees this film. Beautiful actor.
It is. And it was a challenge for me to take Joaquim de Almeida to make this kind of character, because he usually plays mafioso.
He's so gentle.
I mean, it was amazing too.
So gentle.
When we went to Thailand to film, Hiroyuki Sanada, who plays the older Japanese, is a much bigger, you know, through Asia, and is a much bigger star than even Colin. I mean, he was more recognised and what have you. And I think... It's just fascinating to go to other places and see that our, in a sense, hierarchy of celebrity and stardom is completely different in other places, you know.
Must have been a joy for them to be playing these parts and thinking about these issues as Portuguese actors.
Yeah, and for everyone it was important, because we'd make like a light movie, like a comedy, but in the shooting everyone make it with a deep way. Because they are Portuguese, so if you are Portuguese, you feel something special, like we are talking about Portuguese. It's important because maybe it's the first movie, like talking about this way, like for grand public. And so it was like emotion, a lot of emotion in the shooting.
I noticed in your bio notes, Ruben, that you are working on a TV project. Is it an extension or more exploration of this same realm of Portuguese and French culture?
No.
Okay, so we're very different.
Stop this. Yeah. It's completely different. It's for French TV, but I'm in the very beginning. It's about the universe of palace and hotels.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. The behind
the scenes.
Yeah, under scenes. Exactly.
Well, you grew up, as the son of a concierge, so obviously there's a similarity there still. But the other thing I loved was when you cast Joaquim. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, Joaquim.
Joaquim. You found him at Cannes Film Festival looking for food, which you said was very Portuguese. Tell us about that moment.
Yeah, the first time I've met Joaquim, we were in a cocktail in Festival de Cannes, and we met, and 1 minute after, he says to me, "There is nothing to eat here." Because there are like small things, you know, like to eat. And for Portuguese people, it's very important to eat well. So I look at him, I say, "Okay, it will be a perfect José."
Yeah.
So I ask him, and he says, "Okay."
The Gilded Cage. And, gentlemen, it's lovely to meet you both and to talk about these two very, very different films, and all the very, very best.
I'm very curious to see the movie.
And yours.
Ruben Alves, he's the maker of The Gilded Cage, looking at the Portuguese and French community in Paris. Jonathan Toplitzky and his rendition of The Railway Man, that absolutely beautiful memoir by Eric Lomax. David Astle, my co-host, lovely to see you. And don't forget David's new book, Cluetopia, and the story of 100 years of the crossword.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available at abc.net.au/Melbourne. Subscribe now and you'll receive automatic updates with special guests, interesting interviews. It's a bit of fun. You'll be mad not to subscribe. abc.net.au/Melbourne.